Well, we'll just share here. Okay. So we're going to cover some questions that you've written here. If you want to ask a question, I think the best thing to do is just write it down on one of these sheets and give it to me, and then we can kind of sort through and rephrase and group and gather and control time better this way. So yeah, we've already got a bunch. How did things go?
Good, I hope. I had a great time. Thanks so much for having me. Thank you.
Nice. Okay, so first, let's talk a few questions about use of time for kids, motivation for kids, that kind of stuff. Oh, Cliff's going to give us a second mic. Nice. Yeah. So, how much should parents control or monitor their teens' use of technology and electronic devices? What's the appropriate amount of time for that sort of thing, or just kind of time management? How do parents interact with their kids' time schedule?
See, a couple parts to that question. The first part is the control aspect. I think when it comes to technology and teens, I would start them off in public places using it. I would get software that blocks pornography in the entire house. You can do this for a relatively small amount of money that will protect all the devices in your home from pornographic websites. That would be my first thing to want to block out, and I would totally block that out. And then I would start them off using internet-enabled devices in the household. I would let them know that if you have a phone, we have the right to monitor what you do on it. That's an invasion of privacy. Say, you know what, actually in the workforce it's the same way. My employer monitors my email. And I have accountability there. My wife knows my email passwords. I have accountability there. It's safe to have accountability. Teach them that it's good for them to have accountability, that you as a parent don't want to have no accountability in your life. So that would be the accountability freedom aspect. And then the time amount, I would say start them off with more control and less time. And if it's like a video game thing, I would say that can be a nice little reward, maybe set a time limit as a reward for doing good work in your homework, getting all your work done as a recreational activity to kind of rejuvenate your energy in a limited amount of time. Find a time that amount that works for you. It's something that it can't dominate them. Don't let it dominate their life, and watch if it's controlling the way they think about their time. If they're constantly going for it, like with my kids, I found that they were constantly wanting to have iPad turns to play games. I just said, no, we're going to limit it. We're going to scale it back a bit more because you're not controlling it very well. It's controlling you too much. So you got to watch each kid individually.
And can you help me answer my teens that the virtuous loop does not apply to video gaming?
I didn't even think of video games when I wrote the virtuous loop. It applies to doing useful activities. It's about doing things you enjoy. I think as a parent, when you talk to your teen about trying to assess their interests, trying to find their delights, what they like to do, if all they answer is video games and watching movies, then help them to be a little more creative. Give them things they can try that are useful. Help them become aware of needs in the world that they might be able to make a difference in. Short-term missions, serving elderly in your church, things they can do that are useful that then they can feel a sense of pleasure in doing something that ended up helping somebody else. They'll end up having more pleasure and higher pleasures, and tell them that you want to save them, you want to protect them, and deliver them from these inferior pleasures that would otherwise hold them in captivity. So give them more things to think about. Brainstorm with them. What about math? What about English? What about history? Is there anything you like that's academic or intellectual or professional or in some regard? And help them discover that. And keep giving them, and then give them chances to use it and to explore those gifts. And then the virtuous loop will start doing a good thing.
Oh, yeah. These aren't diet, but they're good.
Are they good?
Okay.
Izzy, I'll go with Izzy. Great. Thank you so much.
So, yeah. Kind of joining a couple of questions together that you've already been addressing right now. How do we train our teens to delay gratification? And then kind of along with that, how do we help them to become more independent? Are there camps, programs, extracurricular activities, or stuff that helps them to develop their independence, maturity? And delaying gratification, those two questions together.
Yeah, I think delaying gratification, this is one where I think that athletics can serve a very good role. I saw somebody yesterday at dinner when we were eating at the burger place that historically team-based, school-based sports was seen as part of physical education. We kind of laugh at that now and think, oh, that's just fluff, right? PE is just fluffy class. But historically, physical education was part of a classical education. And what it was about was it was using your body for God's glory and not being overweight or out of shape and thus unable to do good work. So strengthening yourself for the glory of God and also learning endurance and learning discipline. So I think being a part of a sport team can be useful in terms of developing that sense of perseverance and delaying gratification and working hard through practice and then going home and being able to do your homework. I think independence can be learned in a variety of places. Just giving them a chance to step back the management and step up the encouragement and say, okay, we used to do this stuff for you. Whether it's telling you what the homework to do and when to do it or whatever. And now we're not going to. What we want to do instead is monitor once a week how you're doing in it. So stepping back a little bit and letting them step up. And then if they blow it here or there, then you come and help them process it.
A little bit similarly. So as our teens get more and more access to the outside world, especially with cars or with going to friends' houses or whatever, how do you control, monitor what they do outside of the home, even right. Access to pornography outside of the home,
right.
Or going, yeah. Where? How do you monitor or help that?
Well, I think what you can do is a regular accountability time where you can meet with your son or daughter, maybe the father with the son, the mother with the daughter, once a week, maybe for an hour, maybe do it over coffee, take them out somewhere for ice cream, and talk about, okay, how was your last week? Did anything happen that you want to talk about? Have you seen anything pornographic in the last week? Just regularly asking that question, I think, will keep it as a live issue, especially between a father and a son. Just to know that dad's going to be asking me about this, I think, is a good deterrent from it. And just being honest and saying, you know, did somebody show you something? Because I think it's very common to have things shown to you as a young man that you didn't want to see, but some guy at school is going to show it to you on his phone. Well, knowing that your dad's going to ask you about it, knowing that you're going to have someone that you can talk to about it, I think is very useful. Nice. But you can't totally control what happens outside your home. I think that is an illusion. We can't control it. But what we need to do is help our teens manage it and then know that they can come to us and we'll talk to them about it and we'll help them deal with it. If they blow it somehow, they can still come to us. And what they need is grace and help. And knowing that God forgives them, and that we can help them to be stronger for the next time.
Does anybody have any follow-up questions about this specific topic of monitoring our teens, helping our teens become more independent, helping them mature in these ways? Mrs. He, yes.
Yeah, there is a variety of sites. I could send your pastors a link to a website that actually evaluates the different ones that are out there. There's a variety of products that are, some are free and some are small fee subscription fees that have different levels of monitoring, different ways of doing it. So yeah, I would think if you Google internet protection, pornography blocking, you'll find the name of some companies. Covenant Eyes is one of them. I forget the names of some of the other ones that are out there that provide this service. Covenant Eyes is one that I know to be pretty good. And it sends an accountability. It'll send an email to somebody. Like you can have emails sent to the mom or dad or both that cover every website your son or daughter has been to. So you have both. You can both block stuff and then have accountability, because none of these softwares have perfect blocking. If your teen wants to evade it, they can probably find ways to evade it. And then you have the backup is you have an accountability where it's someone sending you an email of all the URLs that your son or daughter has visited.
Yeah, Jeff, you have another?
In fact, the average age is 11 where a boy will have exposure to pornography. And it's usually an accident. It's usually not something that they sought after, but somehow they clicked in the wrong place and something pops up there and the kid's freaked out. Or someone at school shows him something and he doesn't know what to do with it. So I think letting your teens know, hey, this is out there and this is why it's so bad. This is why it's so dangerous. And then they know before it happens or right after it happens the first time and talking about it and processing it with it. But yeah, it's happening younger and younger. So it's important. Setting passwords on, like for example, if you have small children like 8, 9, 10 years old, blocking off your computers. Like our kids are not allowed to use our computers for anything because I don't know what they're going to go find. We give them something to do. Here's an educational activity. This is all you can do is this activity on the computer, and then you're done. And we're watching. We're right in the room with you. So that kind of thing is important. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, there's no reason, and there's no reason why they have to have it in their bedroom. That's what I was saying earlier. Public places, and if they have a phone, take it away at night. Just say, hey, we got your phone, and then, in fact, some of the software, I'll send you the link, some of the software devices that are out there will actually turn off their internet at 10 o'clock at night. You can actually turn it off. So you can program it, they're on the internet, and it's off. It's blocked. So, yeah, I'll send you. Sounds good. Okay.
All right. Yeah, Pastor Mark.
Just in regards to the whole issue of teens or parents talking to their teens, I mean, moms and dads, we've got to take initiative. It may be uncomfortable for us. Maybe we need accountability with one another. Maybe we're struggling with it. You know, this is an issue that's not going to go away. And if we're not going to deal with it head on, then, and one thing that Alex said is that either you dominate your passions.
Responsibilities.
You dominate your responsibilities or they will dominate you. I think.
Yeah.
Passion, same thing. You dominate your passions or your passions are going to dominate you. And that's not just for the teens. It's for us adults as well. We need to take the initiative. We need to have those hard conversations with our teens, with one another too.
So everybody, this is Pastor Mike. He's the English pastor here at T4C.
And this is just one more thing. This is a way you can relate and connect with your teen. We talked about earlier accountability. Like I would tell a teen, you know what, this is how I maintain accountability. I don't have secrecy on my computer. My wife knows everything that I'm doing on my computer and on my phone. I have no way of having secret communications with some other people that she wouldn't know about. And I don't want to have that privacy. And this is why I'm telling you, son or daughter, that you shouldn't have it either. This is why it's dangerous, because things can happen. And this is what I do to fight those sins in my own life. So helping you relate to your teen that we are both fellow sinners before the cross being transformed by Jesus, they know that's not just their problem, it's everyone's issue.
All right. Moving a little bit here. Kind of talk about college entrance, process. So, for example, volunteer hours, volunteer projects, how can that be helpful, or how should a student approach volunteer hours? Is it a requirement to do volunteer hours to get into schools? That sort of thing.
Yeah, so I was telling some guys at lunch as the college-going rate is up 80% in terms of the number of students going to college in the last 30 years, 80% increase. Sometimes people wonder, why is college so expensive? Well, you know, supply and demand, right? So when there's more demand, the prices go up. So people want to go to college, so the college don't have a lot of pressure to lower their prices because everybody wants to go to college. So one of the things that's happened is that at the high end, the better schools are seeing massive increases in applications. I say better schools, more selective schools. Stanford, Caltech, MIT, Pomona, these schools are seeing the number of applicants double every 5 to 10 years. And so what's happened is this is why there's become this race, not just for grades and SAT or ACT scores, but for what's called the ECs, extracurriculars. And, oh, this guy did medical relief work in Haiti, and this guy was working in a lab trying to cure cancer. And what's getting them into college is not just their grades and SAT scores, but the extracurricular activities they do. And this has created kind of a frenzy on the part of some parents that, oh, my kid's got to start doing this stuff when they're 13 years old. And it's kind of overblown. It's really only about 10% of the schools that are really using that stuff carefully to make decisions on admissions. But everyone's kind of getting into it. That being said, quality is more important than quantity. So sometimes I've seen kids try to do like 10 different things to build up their resume, and they think that I just got to do a little bit of everything. What's really more impressive is, okay, when you were a freshman in high school, you were on the yearbook committee, and when you're a senior, now you're the senior editor of the yearbook. You know, doing one thing consistently, kind of having some pattern to what you do, knowing kind of who you are, and being developing leadership practice in a certain area. So being the senior editor of the yearbook and doing yearbook committee for 4 years is more impressive than doing a little bit of this, that, and the other thing. Because a college looks at the person who does this, and they say, this person doesn't really know who they are. This person is all over the place. Who are they? Whereas someone who likes to write and likes to maybe review books on Amazon, and they write for the yearbook, and that's what they do. They do it well. They do it for 4 years. They apply to be an English major somewhere at a good school. That's a good activity. It says this student really is not flaky. This student really has sincere passion for writing and creativity and has been doing it.
Similarly, how do you...
Use your cell phone for questions.
Some of them were posted earlier, right? How do you pick a good application essay topic? How do you write a good essay for school applications?
Okay, so you got to avoid being canned. It can't be artificial. It's got to be something that means a lot to you personally. And what they want to see is, can you write well? And who are you? What are you like? So it needs to be written well. The topic is secondary to how well the writing is. And what they want to know is what an experience that was meaningful to you. Like, here's what you don't want to do. What you don't want to do is like, the Minnesota Vikings won the Super Bowl and it was amazing and I was so happy and I was with all my friends watching the game and it was great. That they don't care about that. That's what they want to know is, what is something you participated in that was meaningful to you? And what did you do in that activity, and how did it transform you and shape you into who you are as a person? So it's really, they want to get to know who you are and what makes you tick, and kind of, do you have a vision for life that's larger than just yourself and things that make you happy? If it's something where you served, something where you were a part of something greater than yourself is very useful. Something that demonstrates your maturity and your concern for broader issues. The colleges are trying to bring in a well-rounded people, and they're trying to develop an incoming class that is diverse in their interests. But individually, they want students who are mature, who have a vision for life that's bigger than just getting a job and making lots of money. So I don't know, I hope that helps a little bit. But it's got to be real. It's got to be something that you did.
Nice. Good times.
And you can use faith stuff. A lot of times students think, well, I'm applying to a secular school. Can I talk about the youth missions trip where I was building houses in Tijuana, Mexico? Yeah, you can. Secular schools care about the application of your faith as part of who you are and how it led to you doing something that was good in the world. That's just something about you that's positive. That's totally fair game.
All right. Just a quick question. What's the difference between a public university and a private university?
Right. So a public university receives state funds per pupil. So like University of Minnesota is is more affordable than Bethel University on average. Hope she's not here. Hope she's not offended. But, you know, and I taught at Northwestern College before I left for California. Northwestern College was now Northwestern University, Christian school, Bethel University, private school, Christian, private Christian schools. They don't get money per pupil from the state. So about half of the costs of educating you at U of M are coming from the state government. And that's why it's less expensive. So short answer is they get state money. And private schools have to compete with those schools without the benefit of that money.
And would you apply to those schools differently? Would your essay be different to one than the other with what they're looking for in a good student?
No. I mean, all public schools are secular. Some private schools are secular. All Christian schools are private. So Christian schools, some of them want only Christian students. Some of them are open to non-Christian students. Among Christian schools, a creedal school, they call it a creedal school, is a school that requires a student to sign a creed, a statement of faith, a profession of Christian faith. My school, California Baptist University, we do not require students to be Christians at our school. And the reason for that is evangelistic. We have about 85% Christian students and 15% non-Christian students, and the hope is that a lot of them come to faith while they're at college in a Christian environment. They do all pledge to live by our rules, which are faith-based rules, obviously, so they can't, you know, alcohol, sexuality, those things are we have rules that secular schools don't have that they have to live by, even though they're not Christians, but we don't require them to be Christians to come there. So among Christian schools, if the school was creedal, they would expect you to have a statement of faith that you sign. So maybe they'd be more disposed to hearing about your faith in your essay. In terms of those kind of Christian schools, would be more disposed, more eager to hear that than secular schools. But all public schools are secular. But they're also okay with hearing about how your faith influences what you do in life, how it influences your goals, and particularly if your goals are service-oriented. That is, it's very attractive. It's very impressive to secular people.
So is there any difference for homeschool background kids in applying to schools, how they write their essays or what schools are looking for, how they compare homeschool kids one to the next?
They are probably looking for... First of all, homeschool students on average outperform public and private students right now academically. And so they'll look at your SAT score, ACT score, more than they would otherwise if you're homeschooled because they don't know how your mom or dad did their grading, okay? Even more so than high schools today where they're concerned about high school grade inflation, even more so with homeschoolers. But so if your SAT or ACT is good and you're homeschooled, you're going to be fine. What they'll probably want to see in the essay is examples that testify to your being socially mature. There still is the stereotype out there that the homeschool kid is kind of a nerd that can't talk to people. That idea is, that, especially if they're non-Christians, that's what they think. I'm just telling you how it is. My own kids are homeschooled, so I can say it. They have that stereotype in their mind. If they're not Christians, they usually think, well, you guys are a little weird. So in your essay, reveal how you worked with people, something that you did with people, showing that you're competent in interacting with adults and other teens your age. Social maturity, social competence was something you're going to want to highlight if you're from a homeschooled background.
All right. Nice. Anything else about college application, what schools are looking for, how to build a resume for college? No?
And so some of the websites I have in my second talk and in my book, I go into this in more detail, is some of those websites are really good for searching schools by affordability or by region or by size. You can put a lot of filters in there and say, I want a school that's in the Midwest with 10,000 or fewer students with this, or this. And they can say these are the schools that are there like that. U.S. News and World Report rankings is really, really ridiculous. It's all wrong. And I should say this because here's the deal. That's all prestige. About 50% of that ranking is based on the image of the school, not based on the quality of the education. And there's ways to game the system to move up those rankings. And so just be aware, that ranking system is not one of the better ones that's reputable.
Okay, we have a stack of questions on paying for school.
Oh, good.
Do I need to put savings into a college fund? This is from a parent. If the parents have savings for college, is it hard for students to get scholarships?
Right. So there's two kinds of aid: merit-based aid, need-based aid.
That was the next question. You're good.
So a lot of people think that, oh, I'm making too much money to get need-based aid. If you're applying to private schools and you have an AGI, adjusted gross income, of anywhere below $80,000, you're looking at probably being a candidate for need-based aid at a private school. Okay? So if you're a candidate for need-based aid at any school, you're better off having some money as parents in a 529 account than in a general savings account. Because the 529 account is a college-sheltered fund. It's a fund where you can grow money tax-free and use it for college. It's kind of like a retirement. It's kind of like a 401k, but it's for college, not for retirement. Even better than that is to have your parents or the child's grandparents have the 529 in their name. Then the FAFSA formula doesn't look at it. Okay, so FAFSA is a formula. It's like filling out your taxes. You know how taxes are very complicated, right? Everything is just massively complicated, massive bureaucracy. FAFSA is the same way, okay? All these different weird rules. And what all the FAFSA is doing is it's calculating a number called the expected family contribution, what Uncle Sam thinks you should pay for college. Now, what they think you should pay for college and what you actually should pay for college are very different things. Remember, the government doesn't exactly manage money very well. So I wouldn't trust them to tell you how much you should spend on college. You should know, you should budget for yourself what you think you should pay for college, and then you should know what they're going to tell you they think you should pay for college, and you should decide whether you're going to pay it or not, or whether, what your plan is going to be to maybe pay less than that. So all that being said, the FAFSA formula doesn't look at it if your parents, the child's grandparents, have money in their name in a 529 account for college that they're going to use for your kid. That's the best way. And the FAFSA doesn't look at it, doesn't use that to determine how much you should pay. What you really don't want, the worst thing, is to have the money in your child's name. So money in your child's name gets taxed at 20% on the FAFSA formula. Savings in your name gets taxed at around 5%. Money in your parents' name, the grandparents' name, zero. So the best plan is to have your parents save. You give the money to your parents, and then your parents put the money in a 529 account, and then the 529 account is used for your grandkids. That's the best way. That's totally legal. It's not unethical. That's totally legal, and they know people do that, and the government wants families to work together. That's why they allow the rules to work that way. If your kid makes a lot of money, let's say in a summer job, and you're going to fill out the FAFSA. Let's say your kid's made a lot of money, and you're going to fill out the FAFSA on February 1st, he should spend it on January 31st. And the FAFSA will actually say, how much money do you have right now? And if you bought a car the day before, it doesn't count. The car is his and the money's not his anymore, and it doesn't count that in his money. So this is some of the weird things about the FAFSA.
In Laverne, people always bought combines before filling out the FAFSA form because $200,000 out of your income. Okay, a question related in the back.
No, the FAFSA for a student. So let's just call the student Sarah. Let's call the parents Tom and Sally. So Sarah, if Sarah makes money, the FAFSA says, well, she's going to college. Sarah's going to college. Sarah should pay as much as she can towards her college because she's benefiting. So if she makes $10,000, what they do is they say the first $7,000 she can keep it. But beyond that $7,000, they want 50%. Okay, and so they'll ask you how much money did they earn the last year, and then that's how they'll figure out what you ought to pay based on that. So unfortunately, it penalizes students from working hard, which is why I said in my earlier talk, if you get work study hours as part of your financial aid package, you should work all those hours you can, because those hours that you work, the money comes straight to the student, and the FAFSA doesn't look at it and take any of it. It's almost like you're getting paid double what you're getting paid, because otherwise, if you work a job outside, they're going to take half of it above a certain limit. If you tutor, let's say you teach piano and you make $20 an hour, well, that's fine up to $7,000. But beyond the $7,000, it's as if you're making $10 an hour. because it didn't take half of it. The work-study job may pay you $10 an hour, but if it's on campus, it's right there. You don't have to drive to someone's home. It's actually coming out ahead. So what I would tell students is do all your work-study hours first. Look for co-ops in your major. A co-op is a cooperative educational program. So a company hires you for a summer, maybe, or maybe they hire you part-time for a semester, and you're doing work that's complementing your academic experience. That money you earn is also not touched by FAFSA. So those are the two best jobs for students, work-study and co-ops. Third best job is either make as much money as you can in some job and know that they're going to take some of it away and say, okay, oh well, I'm still going to come out ahead because I'm making money, or a job that trains you in your certain major that maybe pays you less, but it's training you to be in that certain major, like being a teaching assistant. As an undergraduate student, being a tutor and helping other students, that's a great way. If you want to go to graduate school, one of the things that most grad students end up having to do is be TAs. If you can get some experience doing that as an undergrad, that impresses graduate schools when you go to apply. So maybe you don't make as much money in that TA job, but it lines you up professionally for your future. Is that done? Yeah.
Oh, yes. Now we get questions.
It's called the year of recorders, I think. They look at the last calendar year. So let's say your child is 17 years old right now and going to go to college this fall. They look at 2013, January 1 to December 31. And then next year, same thing, 2014 for going into their sophomore year.
Yeah.
No, what you'd have to do is make sure that internship is a registered co-op. What I would say you should do is have your child do is work with their college to say, hey, I have a job at 3M this summer. What do I need to do to make that a registered co-op? And maybe a little bit of paperwork that their boss has to fill out, or maybe they come back to campus and they write a paper about it, and they somehow tie it into an academic learning. There might be some paperwork there, but I would say I think it's probably doable that you can work it out to make the internship count as a co-op. I worked at a national lab when I was in college, and my college required me to have a co-op to graduate, and I was able to make that my co-op by just filling out some forms.
Students, are we losing you yet? You remember,
you can ask
it's all your responsibility, school stuff. Can you talk just a minute about college loans? I know the teens haven't heard about it yet, but what specifically goes into Stafford loans or like private loans, or how are they different than normal loans?
Okay, so two things. All student loans are, like I said in my last talk, and there's no collateral against them. Okay, when you buy a house, that house is collateral for your loan. And I've known people who've unfortunately lost their house, lost their job, couldn't afford to pay for their house. They moved to an apartment, lost their house. Painful? Yes. But they got out of it. Once that house is gone, off their back, gone. Student loans, there's no collateral and there's no getting out of it. You have to pay it back. Now, the one exception of that is there. If you go into a public service sector, you can have forgiveness after like 10 years. Okay. Let's say you want to teach elementary education in an impoverished neighborhood in the Mid-Twin Cities area. You can probably do that for 10 years, and while you're doing that, you have to pay 15% of your net income to your loans, but after those 10 years, whatever you haven't paid is forgiven. It's gone. Okay, so there are some, you can go to the military. I've had students graduate college and go in the military to have all their loans forgiven. Okay, military will forgive you all your loans in 10 years. And when I say all your loans, I mean all federal loans. Okay, so now let's step back. There's two kinds of loans. Federal loans and private loans. Federal loans have these 10-year forgiveness programs that are out there. Stafford loans are no longer called Stafford loans. They're called direct loans. And they're called direct loans because they're directly given to you by the government and not by any bank. It used to be that federal loans were funneled through banks, and banks had to compete with each other to get your business. Few people realize this, but when Obamacare got passed, the Affordable Care Act, Obama and Congress also took over the student loan business. at the same time in the same law. So I don't know why healthcare and student loans together, but that's how they did it. So now all student loans for federal loans come directly from the government and not through banks at all. And the interest rates are lower in federal loans. They're better, and they have some loan forgiveness programs. So federal loans are where you should go first if you have any need for college money. But even there, you should be very careful, and you should estimate how much total debt you're going to have at graduation, and estimate your income in your field after graduation, so that you don't borrow. Most people tell you don't borrow more than your annual salary after you graduate. My rule of thumb is don't borrow more than half of what you're going to make in your salary. I'm more conservative, and here's why. The average time it takes to find a job for a new graduate now is 6 to 9 months. And after 6 months, Uncle Sam comes calling for their money back, whether you have a job or not. You can apply for hardship, but that won't save you from paying interest rates. So all that numbers to say, federal loans first. Avoid debt your first year, and here's why. Your first year, your major might change, which might cost you another year for college. So don't get loans that first year. In Minnesota, when you're in high school, you can take college classes for free at community colleges in U of M. Right? We have the state has one of the most generous ability for students to do what's called dual enrollment. You ever heard of dual enrollment? Something like PSEO? Yeah. So you can go to like a community college or even U of M and take college-level classes. You can go into your college as a sophomore. That's what you want to do. And then you're only looking at 3 years of loans, not four. Plus, the closer your loans are taken out to your graduation date, the less interest accrues, okay? So calculate how much loans you're going to need, not just 1 year, but until you graduate, and then make sure it's much less than what amount of money you can make in your field when you graduate. The average starting salary right now is between $30,000 and $40,000. Engineers is higher, business is higher, healthcare is higher, nursing, technology, engineering, finance, those are the highest paid jobs right now. Everything else has been kind of flat, 30 to 40K for new graduates.
So wouldn't it be nice if we just didn't have to pay for college? Is there a way to get total scholarships for all of your college? Is that possible?
Sure. Some of you probably will. I've talked to some of you here who have like ACT scores of 35 and 36 and 34. If you're a National Merit Scholar, there's colleges that'll pay for all your school for free. Where I went to school paid for everything if you were National Merit, and I was not National Merit, unfortunately. But they did pay for they give full rides to National Merit students. So the higher you go on your test scores, the more likely you are to get schools to want to pay for most, possibly all of it, especially if they are so-called safety schools, okay? If you are among the top students at a school, you'll get the most scholarship money. My wife went to Stanford University, where her parents also went, and they didn't give her much in the area of financial aid. They didn't offer her very much. She had her parents, her grandparents, some loans. She had to get a lot of things. But other schools were offering her almost total full rides because she would have been a standout student at those schools. Instead, she went to Stanford and was, you know, kind of average in that great in a great school, right? But she was kind of average, so she didn't get much. So that is a factor. I mentioned earlier, if you're going to go in science, technology, or engineering, or math, those the so-called STEM fields, you want to stand out at your college. The research has been done in a book called, it's been presented in a book called David and Goliath by Malcolm Gladwell, great writer, good researcher. If you are among the top third at your college, the psychological benefits of being to the top of the pack are tremendous. And the advantages that come to you from faculty spending time with you, paying attention to you, are also tremendous. That was true in my life as well. I was turned down by Duke University. I applied there for one reason, because they had a good basketball team. That's why I applied there. You can get in games for free if you're a student, by the way. But I didn't get in. So I went to Alfred University, which was a much less selective school, but I was able to be one of the better students there. And I got tons of advantages from that being the case. So don't think you have to go to some great school for your undergrad, because you really don't. You really don't. I mean, yes, it's nice to go to Stanford or Pomona or whatever, but is it worth spending $50,000 a year versus spending $15,000 a year? Is it three times better? Probably not. So consider everything: finances, quality, reputation, but the main thing that differentiates you is how hard you work and how good of a person you are. No one cares that I didn't go to Duke University. No one's ever asked me that. What they care is, did you work hard in college? Did you become a more mature, competent person? Are you willing to work hard at this job? Okay, we can give you a chance to do this job.
At T4C, it does seem like over the past several years, we've had more students choose to go to the safe school type and get big scholarships than go to the more prestigious universities. And so it seems like that's been a definite trend. And it seems like, too, it's nicer to go to the Reach school for your grad degree than for your undergrad, it seems like.
If you're going to get a graduate degree, the reputation of your graduate school it will matter a lot more than the reputation of your undergrad. Okay, if all you do is an undergrad degree, that school that you go to doesn't matter that much. If you go to undergrad and grad, the grad school matters a lot. Like if you're going to get an MBA or a PhD in engineering, you want that to come from a good school. I've had friends who got MBAs and they weren't going to even get one unless they can get into a top 10 school because they said, I'm not going to spend $80,000 to get an MBA unless I know I can leverage that in my career. So they applied 1 year, didn't get in, worked a few more years in the job market, practiced their MCAT, GMAT. Practiced their GMAT, got better at the GMAT, applied again a few years later, got into one of the top 10 schools, and then he went. Because he said, I'm not going to pay for it unless I can know I can make the ROI, the return on investment. That's a smart move for graduate school.
Nice. So, should parents pay for their children's college tuition? In fact, even 100% of their college tuition?
No. No. Don't pay for all of it, okay? Don't pay for all of it. Pay for some of it if you can. But here's the thing. I was asked all the time by parents, how do I get my kid to understand how expensive school is? He doesn't get it. He doesn't appreciate it. I said, well, is he paying for any of it? No. Well, he's not going to appreciate any of it. You need to make him have some of the pain. Make him bear the weight. Okay? The more they pay for, the more they'll appreciate it. I do this in my 8 a.m. class. I mentioned earlier, I get my kids to come at 8 o'clock in the morning to my classes. I tell them, the first day of class, I do the calculation for them. Here's what a semester costs of the school. You're taking 4 classes or 5 classes. Here's how much you're paying per class. Now let's break it down per hour. Now let's break it down per minute. It's over $1 a minute. When you're late to class, you're giving me your money. Do you want to do that? I'm taking it right out of your pocket. Your money is going to me. Do you want to just pay me extra money and not show up? No. Okay, they're all here at 8 o'clock. It's a small little thing I do to motivate, to understand it costs money to be here, so don't miss class. What you can do as a mom and dad is more powerful. Make them pay for part of it. Show them the bill, but break it down. Don't just say, well, it's $20,000 a year. That number's too big to mean anything to them. Tell them it's $2 a minute or $100 50 minutes or whatever it works out to be, and then make them pay a portion of that. What you can do is a system, I've heard a lot of parents do this, and I think it makes sense. If you get these grades, we'll pay this much. If you get lower grades, we'll pay this much. It's a reward system. That's how the world works that way as well. When you're working in the job market, isn't that how you get your raise? If you do a really good job, you get this raise. If you do less of a good job, you get this raise. That is how it works. So those kind of incentive programs can work. Obviously, every family has different amounts of money that they can afford to spend on their kids' college. But some incentive programs, some buy-in, some sharing the weight, sharing the burden. Even if you could pay for all of it, I say don't pay for all of it.
Nice.
Sorry.
Oh, the parents are happy with that. Oh, see, this is worth your $25 to come just to hear that one thing, wasn't it? Teens, now you're regretting this.
One thing for the teens. Okay, yeah. Here's the deal. When you graduate college, if you've paid for part of it, that's impressive to an employer. I guarantee you, an employer that looks at your resume and sees 3 or 4 jobs and you tell him, oh, yeah, I had to make half of the money for my college, he's already more impressed. You show your resume to a future employer and look at all your classes and you say, oh, yeah, in the summertime I just hang out at the beach, playing with my friends. My mom and dad paid for all of it. Now I'm ready to work for you. You say, no, I'm not interested.
Nice. We're going to talk more about at school now, some of these questions. And if you need to stretch or get a drink or anything, feel free to.
Right, thank you.
You too. Yeah, good times. So, school. You know, even at school, you can take higher cost options. So study abroad has gotten fairly popular over the years.
Yeah.
What do you think about study abroad? Is it a good thing? How do you balance the finances? Study abroad?
Study abroad is one of those weird things. It can be good. It can be really silly. Okay. I've seen people do that, and all they do is goof around for 5 months. You know, if they're from a non-Christian school, maybe they goof around and try fancy European beers, right, for 4 months. So not really that interesting. I mean, I think it can be good if you are interested in cross-cultural work someday. Maybe you're in business and you want to do international business. You go to Japan or China for a year or for a semester, and you do work over there, especially some of you who are bilingual in Mandarin. That can be very useful. So I think it depends on the student. And look at how much it costs and look at how strategic it is for what you want to do with your life post-graduation.
My sister leads the one to Europe for the Bethel International Business, so if you guys want to go there. Some schools have like J terms or May terms. That seems to be a shorter time to do a nice study abroad. But anyway, some more questions. So let's talk about Christians in a college now, especially in secular colleges. This first question is, if at a secular college we as a Christian came across an assignment that involves something that we disagree with inherently, mm-hmm. say evolution or say some, I don't know what, should we go along with the assignment or should we not do the assignment? And I may have provoked this question by my workshop.
Oh, no. Okay. I better not say the question's bad. The question's got to be good.
Maybe the answer I gave is disagreeable.
I better give the same answer. I don't think you have the ability to get out of assignments. I think if you're at a secular school and you're assigned to write a paper on evolution, I think you should write the paper on evolution. You should. What I was taught how to write papers, and I think this would help me a lot, is first give the view that the other person has. If you're going to critique something, first state the view in a way that they would think is fair, and then critique the view after you've first shown that you've understood it. So try to understand the evolutionary biology view, describe it in a way that evolutionists would find was fair representation of their view, and then offer some critiques. Now, if you get a low grade on that paper, don't assume it's because you're coming from a faith-based perspective. It's too easy as a Christian to assume the professor's out to get me because I'm a Christian. That is too often used as a cop-out. When I was at Berkeley, I was a TA, and I hate to say this, but some of my Christian students were some of the worst students. And that's because they kind of assumed that I was a Christian, I was going to be easier on them. And the Bible actually warns of that. It talks about slaves and slave owners and says, if you have a believing master, don't slack off because he's a Christian. You think that you can just get away with it. You work harder because that person is a believer. So I have seen Christian students sometimes think, well, I can just get away with doing less work for a Christian TA or Christian professor, or they think, I got a bad grade, the professor's out to get me because I'm a Christian. Don't assume that. It may be true, but don't assume it right away. Go to them and say, I want to learn how to be better. I want to learn how to be a better writer, how to analyze things more clearly. Please help me grow. And if they really are out to get you, they'll reveal that in time. They'll reveal that, and you'll be able to see it, and you'll be able to kind of wisely move away, maybe take classes from other professors. Maybe worst case scenario, you have to file a complaint against that professor. But don't assume it right away. Give them a chance to be who they are. I learned in my last night I told you guys about my first grade in college from a philosophy professor who gave me a B-. He taught me how to write that whole semester after that. He was an atheist, and we had good conversations about faith, and he was respectful, and I was respectful, and I didn't think he was a mean guy. He wasn't being rude to me. He was trying to teach me to be a better thinker, even though we didn't agree on religious issues. I thought he was a very fair and good teacher. So there are lots of good people who, in God's common grace, have skills they can impart to you. Don't assume they're out to get you because you're a Christian. Be an example in your respectful demeanor as part of your witness to them. I'm on Facebook friends with that guy from college 20 years ago.
I'll say he didn't disagree with me. Okay.
Hope not. I don't know.
Good. So this person writes that David Wheaton, is that the tennis player?
Yeah.
Wrote a book called The University of Destruction.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think of that book? Do you agree with it? Is it similar to what your thoughts are? That's the first part of the question.
Yeah, I read it a long time ago. So I wrote a book called Thriving at College, which we ran out of, but you can still get them if you want for back there that people are signing up. And let me just tell you why. Let me kind of contrast why I wrote that book. And not that David Wheaton's book is not good. I think it's helpful at warning about some of the problems that are out there. Why I wrote my book, Thriving at College, was because all that I had seen written to Christian college students was one of two kinds. Watch out, there's all this bad stuff going on out there, which is true. There's lots of bad stuff going on out there. Or here's how you not lose your faith when you go to college. So kind of this view of college is scary, college is horrible, oh no, there's college. I wanted to write something that was positive. I wanted to write something that said, you know what, if you're a Christian student, college is wonderful and it's an amazing opportunity to glorify God in the classroom, socially, relationally, and I expect you to thrive at college. I'm not scared and wondering when you're going to get hit by the next exam or temptation here or there. I am training you to thrive in college. It's a positive vision for doing college well. Yes, there are temptations, but I believe the best way to fight temptations is with superior pleasures. So the way to overcome alcohol temptations in college is to be so excited about what you're doing with your friends and with your academics and with your church and with your campus ministry, and to be so happy and focused on something that's superior that the alcohol thing is silly and ridiculous. I had a friend who came to faith in college, and this is how he tells the story very briefly. I went to a party one weekend, I got drunk to fit in, ended up vomiting for a few hours. The next weekend, someone invited me to an university retreat, and I actually had conversations with people that cared about me, and the rest is history. I mean, his point was, I didn't need to go back to the party and vomiting because I had people who cared about me and who wanted me for who I really was. And so my view is, yes, there's bad things that happen at the university, but the way we fight temptations by being so satisfied in the good things that God has for us, that those things aren't desirable anymore. They fade away.
So to be quite honest, do you think that Christians should all go to Christian colleges?
No. I teach at a Christian college, but I went to all non-Christian colleges all my life, including K through 12. So public schools all throughout college, graduate school. I think every Christian has to decide as a matter of Christian liberty where they should go to college. And there are strategic advantages to both secular schools and Christian schools. There are some kids who are well served at a Christian school, and in some cases they wouldn't have made it in a public secular school. A lot of secular schools are very large, like the large state universities, and they would get lost there. And a Christian school, we were able to really nurture them and care about them and train them, and that was good for them. There are other people who go to secular schools like U of M or University of Texas in Austin or wherever Simon went. And this gives them a chance not only to grow educationally and professionally, but to have the advantage of having access to academic programs that don't otherwise exist at Christian schools. Not every Christian school has biomedical engineering, but University of Texas probably does. U of M probably does. So I think every teen has to do what they think is most strategic for them. And if you are at a non-Christian school, it gives you an opportunity to engage the culture in an evangelistic fashion that's unparalleled. People come to faith in college. The two most frequent times, this is engineer nerd talk here, but if you look at a graph of function versus time, of when people become Christians, it's in the home, 0 to 18, and it's in college. Okay? And after that, to be honest with you, it's not that frequent. On a percentage basis, on millions of people, if you look at it, if you were to ask thousands of Christians, when did you become a Christian, a huge percentage of them, Christian homes and college. Why? Because in college, you're figuring out how to do life. and people get saved in those environments. So you can have a chance to be a part of that by going to a secular college. But I don't think you should go to a secular college just to be an evangelist. I think if you want to be an evangelist, go to the best college you think you should go for your own development, and then go be an evangelist afterwards. So I'm not advocating going to secular school just to evangelize, but I'm saying if you go to a secular school, you have a chance to evangelize that's unparalleled, so make use of that while you're there.
All right, we have three more questions. This first one is very similar to what you've just been talking about, and you've covered this week a bit, but major reasons why Christians fall away from the faith in college and how to prevent that, if you just gave a quick little summary of it?
Two reasons, intellectual and moral. Intellectual, they get persuaded that Christianity is not true. And usually it's not really persuaded. They just kind of get doubts and they never resolve. What usually happens is they get these gnawing doubts. They ignore them. The doubts get bigger. And then they have these lifestyle things that they want to do. And unconsciously, they know that I can sleep around if I'm not a Christian, so it's easier to not be a Christian. Or I can do alcohol more if I'm not a Christian, so it's easier not to be a Christian. So they kind of wander away. Moral impulses pull them this way, and intellectually they have things they never really resolved about the faith, and they get pulled away. That's why I say encourage your teens now to ask questions about the Christian faith. If they're not sure now, now is the time to challenge them. Don't just tell your teens what you believe and why you believe it. Ask them what they believe and why they believe it, and encourage them to wrestle with things now. Is the Bible reliable? Did Jesus really rise from the dead? Did God really create the world? Wrestle with those things now while they're in a safe place rather than when they're out in a university and getting attacked for their faith.
Somewhat related, what do you do in a family that the father and mother don't share the same values? Maybe they're divorced. Maybe one's a Christian, one's not. How do you parent in that situation? Or how do you go through the college thing? How do you have those, I don't know, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I grew up in a mixed house like that. I grew up, my parents were not believers when they married. My mom became a Christian when I was 10 years old. And what happened was a neighbor was offering to take us to church. So at first my mom said, sure, it's free babysitting. Just take the kids. And then she said, well, I should come too. Why don't I come too? And then she became a Christian. And then we all became Christians in due course through that. My dad's still not a Christian to this day. So I grew up, I went through that growing up. I think if you're a parent in the situation, you want to raise your kids and impart your faith to them as much as you would if your believer was a Christian. I mean, my mom didn't hold back on sharing her faith with us growing up. And my dad's on a human level, a very decent and kind person, and no animosity there whatsoever. So I learned the faith from my mom, and I absorbed and became a Christian through my mom's influence, and I'm very thankful for that. If you're a child in that environment, you want to honor your parents as much as you can, but ultimately, and I talk about this a lot in Thriving at College, ultimately what you do as an adult is between you and God. For example, if your non-Christian parents want you to go into engineering and you want to go into something else, I think ultimately you have to respectfully disagree and say, I can't live my adult life for you. That's not what it means to honor you. What it means to honor you is to respect you and to listen to your wisdom and to hear it. But as an adult, I'm not obligated to live my life around your values and your standards and your principles that I don't share. Now, you can still do that very respectfully. You can do that very kindly. And maybe that means you have to work more for your college and pay for more of it yourself. Maybe that's what it means. But I think that has to be handled delicately. But ultimately, as a young adult, where you go in life has to be between you and God, and you have to follow God's call.
So that transitions nicely into our last question. See, you always do this nicely. we've been talking a lot this weekend about what field to go into, major, career, that sort of thing. And a lot of talk about it aligning our passions and our abilities and then the market or competency, as Tim Keller likes to talk about, and that being a way to discern calling. But often in the Bible, people are called to do things that they're not necessarily gifted at, and they trust in God's strength instead of their weaknesses. So how do you balance that if somebody really feels called into something, but they don't seem to have abilities in that? Any way to discern that better?
Yeah, I mean, I think as the questioner thinking about Moses, for example, saying, you know, I can't speak very well. Sure. Why are you calling me? Call someone else, get someone else. Yeah, I think you want to, if they're really interested in something, you want to give them chances to get better and to keep getting better. And ultimately, though, others have to confirm the gift and be willing to hire them, to pay them, to employ them in some capacity doing that. It's a really tough question. I think if they're willing to start off at the bottom, there's an old phrase that says there's plenty of room at the bottom in a career. In other words, there's plenty of room to join a career if you're willing to pay your dues and work your way up and be humble and serve and just work hard. I think you just do that and let the process work itself out over time. And God will reveal it maybe over multiple years. I would never have, if you had seen me in high school, you wouldn't have thought I was a public speaker. For example, I was intellectually oriented. I was a tutor one-on-one with people, but I didn't think about being a professor until after college. And even then, I had to really grow in public speaking. And that was a challenge in the earlier years, to, you know, being prepared for class and then managing the class and those kinds of things. So there were aspects to my job that didn't come naturally for me, but that over time became strength. So I think sometimes, how do you say it? Sometimes the jury's out for a while, and it's too early at the age of 16 or 17 to tell someone what they cannot do. I would say if they really want to do it, keep giving them chances. But then balance practicality with it. Don't necessarily spend $40,000 a year for them to go to an art school if none of their teachers think they're good at art. If they love art, say you could keep doing it, but maybe let's do it on the side while you're going to school for something else. Maybe later on your art flourishes. I never quit my day job when I started writing books. I wrote my first book 8 years ago, and I didn't quit my day job. I still haven't quit my day job. You have to be practical in the sense of everyone has economic things they have to deal with in terms of their responsibilities. So you have to take a long view. A lot of people now in this market are freelancing, are having one job that they do for the bills and one job that they do kind of as a job slash hobby. That's becoming more and more common. I talk to guys who are doing photography on the side, or they're doing an IT company on the side of this other job. I have a friend who's a musician who is a healthcare manager, 40 hours a week. He is a manager like an HMO or something, some kind of healthcare company. And then he writes music, and he writes music for television. So he'll be hired by a commercial, ABC will hire him to write a song for a TV show or something here and there. And he picks up jobs like that. And he'd love to do music full time, but he just can't make a living doing it. So the reality is he's doing that side. If God opened that door to do that full time, he would do that full time. But that's not what God's opened yet. And so he's being faithful to his talents and to his sense of call, but he's also being practical and realistic and honoring God by earning a living. So I think a lot of us have to balance that, and maybe it takes more than 4 years to balance that.
It seems to me, too, like in the Bible, when God calls somebody to do something, but they don't have the abilities to it, he still brings the results.
Yeah.
So if somebody was called to be a preacher, just didn't have very good communication skills, still the members of the audience would be really moved by the right. Spirit, and it would be the Spirit moving and convicting and bringing all those stuff, even though if outside evaluator evaluates him, they're like, you don't seem to be a very good preacher. And so I think if you're doing where the Holy Spirit is calling you, even though your abilities don't match up, you should still see evidence of fruit of it doing some good, or else you develop. Anyway, these are our questions that we've had, and it's been a long day for you, but I hope it's been very informative and helpful to all of us. Teens, I'm not sure if you found it as helpful as your parents did, but that's partially because I don't think you yet sense what all is at stake, and your parents probably do. And parents, you probably sense too much is at stake here. And from our youth staff perspective, a lot of ways, I think we would just tell you, calm down, it's okay. And if you put too much pressure on your kids to think your whole life depends on college and your grades right now and all this stuff, it doesn't. It really doesn't. Your whole life depends on you continuing to mature, to grow in your faith and in your walk with the Lord and becoming who he wants you to be. But it doesn't all depend on grades in school and even what career you're in. Oh, you know what? That reminds me. My article that I missed, I thought I printed it, but I didn't find it, was about the value of working with your hands. And I think we, there are some careers that we want to push people in or some things, but you know what? You can serve the Lord really, really well, and you can have a very fulfilling life and career in fields that we don't normally think, oh, you should be a mechanic. But yeah, there's a lot of need for that. There's a lot of skills that you can use to serve God as a mechanic or as a whatever. And so, yeah, you parents, you sacrificed a great deal. And for you, you worked really hard, most of you, to get where you were, to get your achievements. And you know what? You did such a good job of that, that they don't actually have that same pressure. They can succeed really well by exploring areas that they are interested in now, exploring areas, and they can, you know, and so teens, you owe your parents a very big thank you for what they have done to set the pace for you, and thank the Lord for how he's blessed you and how he will continue to bless your teens and be faithful to them. So on one hand, relax. On the other hand, step up a little bit, teens. But yeah, we thank you for Alex and his perspective on all of this. So
thanks.
Thank you very much.